Good morning. Today we have with us Peter Lowe and our favorite VAM, Brian Weiss from iTech Solutions. Peter, should I be giving DNS Filter my money?
Hey, a few minutes ago, just before the recording started, I did say that I'm not much to do with the product side of things. So, I mean, yes, obviously, because we're the best in the business.
Great answer. Gentlemen, that's it for the day. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
So what exactly do you do over there, Peter? Just so everyone has a little context.
So I head up the domain intelligence side of the company. So we have inside the company the DSDI team, which is data science and domain intelligence. And together we own the research side of the company. We own the data, the DNS data. And the data science is data science, and they look at the data and try to pull out new information for us. And domain intelligence use that data and try to make it better. So we have a tight feedback loop with them where, you know, we process domain reports from customers to whether they've like incorrectly classified domains or new things that we've missed. But we also ingest all the, we have like 50 or 60 different feeds from different places that we pull in. And we have our WebShrinker product behind the scenes, which does content classification of websites to detect threats and classify, because we have a, you know, all sorts of different content categories as well, like social networking and job sites and adult content and stuff like that. That's the sales pitch.
What type of threats are you guys seeing these days or working on identifying?
So, I mean, we focus on the DNS side of things. And pretty much the usual stuff. I don't know if the usual means much to you guys, but so we're looking at DNS tunneling. We look at just malware that's being hosted somewhere. We protect on two fronts. So we prevent people getting infected in the first place, or prevent them getting attacked, by hopefully stopping them ever getting to bad stuff that is able to infect them. But then afterwards, there's a million other ways you can get affected other than, a domain. So it could be a URL or via a proxy or a dodgy USB stick or whatever. And then if that happens, then hopefully we can protect people against we can mitigate the effects of being affected. So one of the big things we do is prevent access to C2 servers, which is, you know, the main way of controlling a piece of ransomware that might be installed in your network. So if you are infected, then hopefully the infection won't be able to do anything. It won't be told to encrypt any hard drives on your network. That's one of the main things. And phishing is probably the single biggest thing that we protect against. And again, we try and prevent people from being infected by, if they click a dodgy link in an email, show our blog page. The other thing I should mention is that you do have to create a policy which protects you from these threats as part of DNS filtering. You have to go in and say, yeah, I want to be protected against phishing or malware.
What type of threats are you guys seeing now that, you know, Europe is on fire or Ukraine is on fire?
The types of threats are probably, haven't really changed. But where they're coming from has perhaps changed a little bit. So we did something on this recently where we looked at malicious domains that we'd seen since August. And there'd actually been a big uptick coming from .ru domains since August. It was something like 1 or 2% from all the malicious domains we've seen. But percentage-wise, it was something like a 400% increase since then. So I don't have the figures actually I had, but it's difficult to draw conclusions, but it supports a hypothesis that cyber activity has been increasing from that part of the world in the last few months.
Now, are you guys tracking the origin, meaning, I guess, geographic origin, these IPs or these DNS queries?
We can do. We do kind of, but we don't. We have where the request IPs are coming from, but that's our clients. And we have the IPs that they resolve to, but that is, it varies. And yeah, so there's this, you know, we kind of, it doesn't change that much, really. Like the actual statistics don't, the numbers don't vary that much between the TLDs and the geographic locations. So trading wise, which is what we look at, is they're fairly consistent.
Okay. The reason I ask is because we've been seeing a lot of C2 servers being stood up in South America and the Caribbean, more so than we've been seeing in Europe.
That's really interesting. That's something that I could look into. Yeah. Spikes like that are the kind of thing that we look at. If we notice something. And so how recent are these?
We started seeing it in late November. And then it really took off in early January, I would say.
And have you done any investigations into the actual, like the servers and everything? Is it any particular malware actor or?
It's a lot of the usual players. Now we're seeing a lot more of Lapsus. I mean, but I think a lot of these ransomware operators, they operate in waves.
And yeah, that's true.
I've always been of the opinion when one particular group is not doing anything, they're actually at home refining their TTPs and their product to come back stronger.
Yeah.
You know, whereas we in general, the end users tend to rest on their laurels. But it's interesting because we started seeing the spike late last year and especially early this year. And now everything's going on in Ukraine, which makes me wonder, have they been moving their area of operation?
Yeah, it's really difficult to say, isn't it? I mean, what do you think, first of all? I mean, do you think that's the case, or do you think it's just a coincidence?
I don't believe in coincidences. I think...
Okay.
I think deep down, some group of people knew what was going to happen. And if they're smart, which most times they are, more times than not, they are smart, they will spread out their infrastructure in places that are friendly to where they have been operating from. And traditionally, a lot of the ransomware groups, as far as I know, and I'm an idiot, so I know nothing, have operated out of the Ukraine, or a lot of the affiliates have been out of the Ukraine. So if they knew that was going to become a highly contested area, it would make sense for them to spread infrastructure outside of Eastern Europe.
That's really interesting. I was thinking that the hypothesis your inference might be that it was Russia themselves who were trying to move their infrastructure away from Russia. Like, so the Russian government would...
I would think all of the above. I wouldn't carve them out of that. I would say them. I'd say their affiliates, the operators. I mean, let's look at it in three groups, right? You have the Kremlin, then you have the actual ransomware group, and then you have the affiliates.
Yeah.
And I would say any one of those three groups, it would make sense for them to operate outside of Eastern Europe.
Yeah. What I found quite surprising actually was that it seems there's less of a connection. And then again, I'm an idiot, so I know nothing as well. There's a less of a connection between the government and the groups themselves. There's definitely something, but like, it feels like in the past a few weeks, there's been less, fewer attacks than I would have expected. Fewer direct attacks on Ukrainian infrastructure.
You know, I was floating this idea with on Twitter with one of the guys from Recorded Future that I know.
Oh yeah.
And I said, because everyone's asking, why isn't Russia doing its cyber warfare? Right? Why hasn't Russian cyber ops leveled the Ukraine? And
yeah,
my thinking is there's already war and suffering going on over there. The world has been suffering with supply chain issues. If you look at some of the larger hacks in recent times, Denso, NVIDIA, chip manufacturers, that will further constrain the supply chain. So I think that's where the cyber warfare is going to be. And if any country goes after another country's critical infrastructure, that's a declaration of war. Not that, you know, sending troops in isn't. Don't get me wrong there. But, you know, you don't want to spill over into someone's systems that gets a third party in to the war.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think they're also quickly reevaluating how they're going to do it as well. I think it might be ramping up. The thing to me was that surprised me was that it seems to be more of like, it's cheaper to send, to launch a cyber attack than it is to send real people in. But maybe Russia just doesn't care about that, that side of things.
I just think the plan is just to do it all. Why limit yourself? I mean, as bad as that sounds.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I saw a really interesting, this isn't specifically to do with cybersecurity, but I saw a really interesting comparison of American companies versus Chinese companies. That was some people who worked at Facebook and at TikTok, and they were talking about how in TikTok, they don't have automated testing as part of the software development lifecycle. They don't have like unit tests and stuff. They just have massive QA teams that, because labor is so much cheaper, that they just, this brute force it, basically. Everything that's released, even if it's like a multilingual thing, a little tiny feature. oh yeah, and they have specific product teams for each tiny feature. Because they have so many people working there, they don't need automated testing. But in, you know, Facebook, it's a totally different situation. And also there's four times as many PhDs in China, apparently. So maybe that's kind of similar thing with Russia. They just have more soldiers to throw at the issue. But you're right. They're definitely, yeah. Sorry.
How, Brian, you want to, I don't know if you want to hop in.
Yeah. Sorry, Brian.
I'm enjoying the conversation. I'd love to talk more about DNS filter, but we can talk about Russia more too.
Yeah. But Peter's from DNS filter. Let's talk about both. How can Brian how is your intelligence in the company helping Brian protect his customers from Russia using DNS filter?
Well, I have a couple questions. I am curious kind of where you fit in on the intelligence sharing, right? Because obviously you identify these IPs, you know, via DNS routes that are trying to happen that are malicious, right? And that IP information is, that'd be valuable for, say, a firewall company for their definitions, right? To kind of know that. So can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, you gather all this intelligence. Do you get intelligence from other sources as well? Do you share out the intelligence you're gathering? How does that work?
So at the big question, first of all, we do some limited intelligence sharing, and I'm part of a couple of groups that are specifically to do with CTI and DIC, Threat Intelligence Coalition, and Cyber Threat Intelligence, that they're kind of trying to work together to do more for each other. The industry has a big problem with sharing intel. Because it's part of everybody's secret sauce. It's one of the...
It's your revenue, right?
Yeah. And it's the one of the key factors that people look at when they're choosing who can protect them best, who's got the best threat intel. It's a bad thing for the world as a whole, because, you know, we could probably solve a lot of our problems if everybody shared their all threat intelligence. So I would like to do more personally. I'm a geek. I'm a tech guy. I want to share more, but I'm limited in what I can do. But there are a couple of things that we're looking into. this one group that I'm part of is specifically, it's got some really big people in there. It's like Google and Microsoft and stuff. But it's quite small, and we, you know, it's talking one-to-one, but it's not very active. Also, we have a guy starting soon who's going to be focused entirely on threat intelligence. And one of the big things I'd like him to do is set up some regular way of threat intelligence sharing, so that we can, you know, give out the data that we have in some way that doesn't lose us money, basically, in the end. You know, there's a couple of ideas we got, which I don't really want to go into the details of, because...
Don't
work out.
Live thing on the top. This is recorded, and we'll put it out later. We won't have to let everyone know what you're talking about. Don't worry.
right. No, I mean, it's a couple of things that we're looking at. I really hope they will, and I'm hopeful that things are going to happen. There's another challenge that inside DNS filter, we're expanding a lot. So, you know, last year we got Series A funding, and it took a couple of months for that to be almost allocated. And then we went through this massive hiring phase. We're still in the hiring phase. So we've got a bunch of people coming in, and we're adjusting to some processes. And then my team has grown quite a bit. which is great because I am able to take off a few of my hats, like I mentioned before. At one point I was doing sales for WebShrinker. I don't know if you're familiar with WebShrinker. It's the, So the story behind WebShrinker is before 2018, I think it was, DNS Filter relied on intelligence feeds from external sources to classify domains. Then they came across WebShrinker, which does, it's an AI that can go off and automatically classify any website. And there's a bunch of different indicators thrown in there as well. What DNS Filter liked it so much, they were a massive customer to begin with. WebShrinker.com, if you want to take a look, it's still its own product. They acquired WebShrinker, partly because it was, you know, cost effective, but also because they didn't want other DNS filtering companies to get their hands on it. So that's one of the main things that does the content classification for DNS Filter. And it's able to proactively identify, I've derailed myself there with the sales pitch for WebShrinker.
We were talking intelligence and kind of sharing it, right? Because I see one of the issues I have is I have all these different security products that all get their own intelligence somehow.
Yeah.
And I'd love them to be able to share that intelligence, or I'd love to be able to say, hey, DNS Filter knows about all these bad IPs. Why can't I make sure my firewall is just auto blocking those altogether, right? Why is my firewall depending on a different set of intelligence that may not block that IP? So now I'm having to rely on DNS Filter to do it, right?
Well, yeah, I see where you're coming from, but there's no silver bullet in security.
The onion. Everyone says the onion works. Spend more money.
Spend more money, right. Well, so yeah, money is the silver bullet. But yeah, I mean, DNS Filter is a great way. It's an excellent, easy to deploy layer to protect you against a lot of stuff online, but you're still going to need other ways. With IPs, you're going to get a ton of false positives as well. You know, shared service, you're going to block a lot of legit content. And DNS Filter as a service, one of the focuses we have is avoiding false positives.
For you.
Yeah, sure.
Now, I've never used DNS Filter. Actually, oddly enough, someone called me from DNS Filter yesterday.
I'm out.
But hey, I'm doing a demo with you guys tomorrow because someone called me yesterday and was like, hey, have you heard of us? I'm like, doing an episode with Peter tomorrow. And I think it was probably like some outsourced sales company because he didn't know what I was talking about. He's like, oh, well, can we set up a call? I'm like, sure, why not? Let me take a look at it. With that said, is DNS Filter agent based?
Yeah, we have a deployment method. It's not totally agent based. It can be based on other ways of using it, but you know.
So are you familiar with Sophos, the AV firewall company?
I've heard of them. Yeah, I think so.
Small company.
Rings a bell.
Yeah. I used to be a user of them. Brian here is. Part of their AV package allows for web filtering. Have you guys, and I'm just using them as an example because I kind of know, I spent a lot of time using them and I know them pretty well. Is there any version of an integration between a DNS filter and something like a Sophos endpoint manager or a Sophos endpoint protection agent where through API you can feed your block list to them? So now it's one less agent for me as a provider to drop onto something, especially with work from home.
I think with Sophos, I don't know if we're talking to them or not. I don't know if there's an integration in development or not. I'm sorry.
Oh no, not for them. Just the idea of it where you're feeding into an AV platform that already has a module to control the Windows firewall.
That's a really good question.
I take royalty.
I'll send you a discount code for 3 months. How about that?
30% is better. But to me, I think that would be really interesting because especially with most of the security products in some version of a command and control infrastructure, I would think it can save you as a company dev time if you can integrate with their platform, feed them a block list, so to speak, or the policies, and let their agent do the heavy lifting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can see that what you mean. You want to integrate the solution, and that's fair enough. I think that's definitely something the company is looking at. In a the problem, well, not the problem, but one of the challenges is which way do you come at it from? Do we add that capability to our service, or would we integrate with someone else who's already doing it? Or is there some kind of bridge that does both? There's also advantages you get from DNS filtering that you won't get from a secure web gateway, which is it's faster. DNS lookups are, you know, sub 10 milliseconds. So you're going to get a response back saying that's bad instantly, almost. But with the secure web gateway, it's going to take a lot longer to get that feedback. So,
okay. I just thought it would be an interesting way to add you guys in, and you become more of a threat intel company as opposed to a product company, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It helps the Bryans of the world.
You know, I don't want to talk too much about the product because I'm probably going to embarrass myself and say the wrong thing. But definitely talking about different ways we can have that kind of capability. So
I mean, that's the IP at DNS Filter, right? Is you've got your threat intelligence and you've got your efficiency at which you can deliver it, right? There's a couple other things too that are kind of, you know, one of them's already here, HTTPS or DNS over HTTPS. I was wondering if we should dive into that at all. The other thing is your new AppAware platform. I really like the direction that's taking. I don't know, Shiva, if you want to dive into any of those.
Why not? Hey, as long as I learn something, I'm happy.
They're both big topics.
Would much prefer secure DNS if Brian's okay with that, or both. I mean, sure. Whatever.
But do you mean encrypted DNS?
Encrypted DNS, sorry, yes.
Yeah. Sure. So we've supported DNS over TLS since day one, as far as I know. And that is essentially the same protocol as DNS, but it uses a different port and it has an SSL handshake or TLS handshake that happens. So it's like the difference between HTTP and HTTP. It's almost like that analogy is very close. DOT has been around since about 2016. I think the RFC was made official then. DOH, or DOE, as DOT and DOE are the two people call them. Was been around since about 2018. And the idea is to, it's supposed to be more resistant to privacy invasions. Because by essentially tunneling DNS traffic over the HTTP port, which is 443, it kind of looks like web traffic. It's much harder to block. So you can't just close off port 853, which is DOT. And prevent encrypted DNS. There's a lot of issues with it as a protocol, because it's, in some places it's had almost the opposite effect. There are countries where they have nationally managed DNS block lists, and that's been an easy thing for them to implement, and they can block DOT and just put in. I worked for a gaming company a while back, and they had example.com as their main domain, but they also had pre-registered example 1, example 2, example 3, example 4, example 5, because, all the way up to example 50.com, because they were so used to getting added to the national blacklist because gaming is illegal in Turkey. And they was built into the system to switch over to the new domain. That kind of thing is, in places like that is a real, and what DOH has done is it's implemented a bypass to that. Now the country is going to have to invest more in deep packet inspection and other ways to control what people are looking at. So it was intended as a privacy thing, but it actually kind of didn't work out that way. Also, some people might say that some companies who are providing DOH service like Google and Cloudflare may have had a vested interest in promoting it and making sure that the technology succeeded despite some of the issues. Another thing is the fact that it was implemented on the browser level to begin with. So you can configure your own DOH server in Chrome or Firefox. And that, again, bypasses any kind of system level DNS settings that you have. So for people, for example, at the beginning, if you use DNS Filter, any of the people on your network, any of the end users could just go and change their their DNS server inside Chrome, and they wouldn't be getting the protection from DNS filter. We do have a DRH server, and it is available. I think there's some details on the support website. There's a whole bunch of other things, like the fact that it's being introduced in macOS and iOS and Windows, and you can configure it at 50 different layers and 50 different apps, and it'll be different, and you can miss one of them, and then that will be infected. I'm not a huge fan, I have to say. It's slower as well, because it's got the overhead of sending the HTTP packets, as well as the DNS. I'm still ranting. Come on, Shiva. All of these things are being looked at, and they've been flagged. And you know, there's things like, if you have a group policy configured on an Android device, then Chrome won't automatically try and use DOH or prevent it being used. And there's a canary domain for Firefox and all sorts of things like that. And the DOH servers are being optimized so that it's actually round trips are getting much closer to standard DNS. But it shouldn't really be like that in the first place. And there's some people who will say I'm completely wrong, by the way. It's the best thing ever.
How does a DNS filter deal with this and C2 domains or ransomware or malicious actors?
DNS, it's tricky. It's the real answer. Because if a DNS filtering company, it gets bypassed, they can't do anything, really. There's a couple of things, actually. That's not true. So with Firefox, for example, there's a canary domain, which means that it's a special domain that we respond to in a special way. It's called use-application-dns.net. And if you query that domain to get a no error response, then Firefox will not try and use the DOH. So it's just a way of indicating that the network you're connecting to doesn't want you to use anything different other than the system level DNS server. Chrome has a thing where it tries to detect a group policy on the device, and that will work around the local DOH settings. I think Windows has another way of looking at it, and I think Apple has another way for iOS and for macOS. So there's things that are, workarounds, but it's a pain in the ass, I have to say. There's a new thing called DDR, which is dynamic or designated DNS resolver. And these are special domains, which you can query when your device connects to the network, and it can tell you what are the desired servers to be using. So you say, what is underscore DOH dot something dot ARPA, and it will give you back an IP address and how to access the DOH will be the server name. So yeah, mechanisms are being worked on.
Now, with your agent, can you force DNS resolution through your servers?
Not if the application doesn't try and use the agent.
Okay.
If an app tries to connect externally to port 443 on something, it's going to be allowed. If it's a browser, it's going to be allowed. So with DOH, it causes a real problem for companies like us.
Now you see where I'm talking about. I would love your intelligence in my firewall, right?
Yeah. There's a couple of, I know what you mean, but we would have to, DNS filter would have to cooperate with the bundle, which you use Sophos, but then someone else uses McAfee and someone else uses Norton. Oh, and Norton McAfee. Same these days.
I would just go straight to Microsoft and be like, hey, we're going to work with Microsoft's firewall first, right? I mean, I don't really need it at my gateway.
It's a question of how you would interact with the firewall is tricky.
I think Brian means the Windows firewall.
Right. But then how would the Windows firewall know which domains are bad? If we go to Microsoft, do we sell it to them or license it to them?
They use, they're doing it with Cynet, I think.
Or really?
Oh God! One of those. It's a company that does DNS lookups. Starts with a C. I think it's Cynet. I'm not sure. And they they give you, I think, 2 months free, and then you have to pay for it after, as a Microsoft E5 customer or business premium customer. And at that point, they're tying it into Endpoint Manager, or the ATP endpoint protection. Maybe that's something you guys can look at. And yeah, I can email you the link offline.
And, you know, yeah, you could go the route licensing through Microsoft or just build an integration and then make your money to the direct end customer, right? Hey, I use Microsoft Windows. I want this extra feature from DNS filter that I'm not already getting, so I'll pay DNS filter for it, right?
Is there a way to encapsulate all the data going in and out through your agent on a Windows computer? Because that would be a lot easier to do than go creating an integration that, all over the place.
That would be more of a proxy approach, right?
Well, yeah. We have a relay client, which can is a kind of proxy, but that normally sits on a server or something. So it's getting into an area where I'm not so comfortable, to be honest. I'm not I can focus on the actual threat intelligence and what we're looking at and where we get it from and how we use it, but it's a product integrations. Bit rocky ground for me. I'm sorry.
Do you provide intelligence to your partners on best practices, right, for DNS filter? You protect a certain layer, but I'm sure you could have other layers unprotected that could potentially render DNS filter, you know, someone could bypass it, right? I mean, there's certain things you might want to have set up in place alongside DNS filter, right, to help it work better, right? I mean, is there anything?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one thing I can think of, especially around this DNS over HTTPS, is you're limiting browsers. You're only letting the end client use one browser, right, that then DNS filter can keep a better eye on versus, oh, they're using all these other browsers, and how are these other browsers configured that we don't know about, right?
Interesting question. I know that we have, as a company, we're trying to provide a zero trust infrastructure for people. And we think that is basically the best way to go, where you don't trust anything by default. But for other practices, I think we do have some documentation in the support docs, but I don't really know where it is. Interesting question. I think I might follow up with that internally.
Well, you brought up a good point, right? Like Google Chrome can literally be programmed if the end user had the right, you know, role access to bypass your product, right? And then, so, you know, it seems like that type of thing should be made aware so that we're not using your product thinking that we're protected when really we aren't, right?
Yeah. Well, the one thing you can do, and we recommend people to do, is to block in whatever policies you have set up, is block the proxy and filter avoidance category. That does a lot of the heavy lifting in avoiding, preventing people from circumventing DNS filter in the first place, and other filtering stuff that you might have in place.
How does AppAware work? Because I'm thinking, depending on the answer to that, that can help with a lot of this getting to a zero trust-ish type of posture.
Yeah, that's one of the intentions of it, is to try and block things that you don't want to use. So when you say, how does it work?
What is it? What is the product?
So basically, you're able to get, well, beforehand, you could come in and say, I want to block job websites or different categories of domains. There's about 40. And AppAware is, you're able to block specific applications, in a nutshell.
Okay, so like a Dropbox, not to pick on them, but it's just the first name that came to mind.
Yes. Okay. Well, when you mentioned it earlier, I said, oh, that's a pain in the ass. because it seems simple as a concept. You're able to block individual apps, but on the when you get into the details, it's a lot more complicated than you might think. For example, when we started off, we had a lot of these things like, I want to block X. X turns out to be a lot of different products, and then other sub products, and then those products conflict with other things, and then one of them will change, be sold off to someone, and so management of all of this is it's tricky. We have something what we call an ecosystem app. So this came up with LogMeIn recently. So when you say you want to block LogMeIn, what do you mean exactly? Do you mean
don't let the Indian call centers into your computer?
Right.
I can say that.
Yeah, I'm not going to go. So Logme is a good example. They have a ton of different products and services. And so, I think originally we had on the list Amazon, which, you know, what does that mean?
Exactly? How dare
you? Yeah.
I have to be able to shop in the middle of my workday that I'm being paid to do something else.
Yeah. And actually refining the associated domains is tricky as well, because one of the common things that we had was that people want to block Fortnite. Like parents want to stop their games, their kids playing Fortnite all the time. But that actually turns out to block a whole bunch of other things. That was tricky. Because the servers used by Fortnite are...
It's probably all AWS. So it's all shared infrastructure to some degree.
Yeah, but the domains are... Actually, quite a lot of it is AWS. But the domains are what we're blocking, not the...
Okay.
They don't point to actual AmazonAWS.com.
There was a product I used to use ConnectWise Automate, and there was a plugin called Third Wall. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not, sorry.
There was an option where they gave us a checkbox. I'm sure there was a lot smarter people in the background doing that coding, but you can block various type of storage accounts, websites, email providers. So if you wanted to block someone from resolving to say Gmail, you check that box and it makes the registry changes and that's it. You couldn't get... Nothing you did, you can get to Gmail from that computer unless you effectively changed that registry entry or unchecked the box.
Third wall, you called it?
Third wall, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'll take a look. It's interesting. I think there's a whole group of companies under the application intelligence area, which... much more detailed than just the domain. So this, you know, registry keys, some of them did DPI.
Third Wall did everything for the most part via registry keys. So you can, you know, back then they made it really easy to prevent people from using USB devices and locking down the security of a endpoint.
Wow.
A lot of different products have come a long way since then, but I was just curious if you were doing it, blocking the applications the way they do. So how are you guys blocking the app, or what exactly is AppAware? Because I think I might have missed that.
So you come into your policy configuration in DNS filter, and you say I want to block Skype or Facebook Messenger or Fortnite, and then the domains associated with that service or application or platform or whatever app we call it should then stop functioning.
Okay. And this, do you need the agent on for this?
No.
Okay.
No. You can use a deploy method. So the agent is just a handy way of getting your DNS requests to our servers, but you can access it by direct IP address.
So yeah, I was going to say it blocks it using DNS, right?
Yeah.
So there's no Chivo's wondering if you actually go into the OS and change things there, you know.
Sorry, I didn't.
So yeah, and the idea is it's really the IP there is really the intelligence, right? If you think about like we've got this desktop app frontier that we've had, right, where everyone is running all these desktop apps, and we got to be worried about which ones we want to allow, not allow. Pretty easy to do with some tools that are out there now. You remove local admin, use a third party tool, you can easily lock that down, create your whitelist, blacklist. It does checks for you if you're unaware of the desktop app, whether or not it might be safe, right? So on the fly, you can kind of identify that. But we're moving away from desktop apps, right? Like the new frontier is all cloud apps. I personally can't wait till I don't have to support desktop apps anymore, right? but then you look at that security layer that you had in place to meet that control. And it's not working anymore because we're dealing with cloud apps instead of desktop apps. So now what new control are we going to put in place to manage a cloud app policy, right?
Easy. Zero trust. Block everything and allow one at a time when people yell, scream, and complain.
That's the boil the ocean approach, I guess, right?
It's fun, isn't it?
So I was really happy to see your product come out. I feel like it's got a lot of potential. I could see it going into even maybe role-based blocking, right? like, hey, this user can go to Facebook, but they can only do these items on Facebook, right? Because you are going to have situations where companies can't just straight up block a full app, but they might want to block certain aspects of it.
Or right? People allow certain people to do.
Or yeah, obviously down to the user level. As
like,
well,
you know, the
right?
owner should be able to see whatever they want, but yep. everybody else should not be able to go on Amazon.com at work.
So what I'm really curious to know too, are you part of that team at all? Or are you just kind of domain intelligence that works with that team?
Yes, I am part of that team. I'm part of the product side of it, or the develop, you know, the feature side, but that falls under what we know about domains. We know that a domain is associated with a particular application.
Yeah. So in a way with AppAware, you're kind of keeping updated definitions of what are all the domains that are associated with this app, right?
Yeah.
Are you publishing is a very loose term here, within the portal, are you publishing what that client, are you publishing a list of domains or products that client is going to, and then
yeah.
choose to block that? Or is it just one big master list that you choose from, or both? Okay, let's say for the sake of argument, your list only has Microsoft and Google or Apple.
Yeah. Right.
And then an endpoint report to say, hey, we're going to yahoo.com. Does yahoo.com now get added to the list as a site or domain that has been visited by someone in that company?
Yeah. Well, we have full reporting for all DNS requests.
And then it's able to add or block.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether you can do it directly from the query log, but you can, we have reporting, which is a kind of aggregate overview of what your network has been doing. And then we have the query log, which is like what each individual DNS request that's been sent from your network.
Okay. No, so sorry. What I meant was, is there a list that's generated for that client dynamically based on the traffic? And then from that list, can you add or can you block or whitelist? I guess is the question. Instead of having to go through a full list of all the applications that you guys may already have or know.
Oh, I see. So you see a domain being accessed, and then we could say that's associated with X, app X, and then you can block app X, and that'll block everything else.
Right. Or whitelist, whatever you want to do.
I don't think that's actually been built as the first version, but that's a really interesting idea.
Shiva stole some of my fire because I was going to actually jump right into some things I'd like to see with the AppAware that I think are definitely needed. And it really comes down... It's around those discussions with the client. Right now you go in there, you have a list of currently supported cloud apps, and it's like, hey, do we want to allow these or not allow these? I use another product called Augment, which takes a different direction, and it actually does exactly what Shiva just mentioned. First, it collects data on all of the cloud apps being used by the organization. Then you sit down with the client, have the discussion of which ones do you want to allow or not allow. And then typically, you know, if it's a larger client where maybe they've even got an in-house SOC, they're having weekly meetings where they're reviewing new sites that were, or new apps that were accessed, right? And whether or not those should be allowed moving forward. So it's this idea of kind of security and compliance, you know, taking the next step and understanding that, hey, because we're using this tool to appease a control in our security framework, we also need a way to easily report, update, understand what people are using so we can classify on the go. And it's more of a organic way to create your policy versus starting off with some predefined list that you don't really have intelligence on what your users are even using in the first place, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, that comes back to what I mentioned before about application intelligence. And that's what those kind of companies provide. Much, you know, on a much finer grain level than we do. We saw a need for this feature, and that's what we've implemented so far. But there are, there's a plan. This is V1, you know.
There's one thing based on what you both have been talking about that I would like to use something like this for, and that's to identify shadow IT.
That's hopefully coming, but I can't give you a timeline.
Okay, because that's the bane of my existence, right? No matter how tight you think you can keep a client's network for installations, yeah. there's always something that can slip by. And I'll use Zoom as an example because you don't need to elevate privileges to install. You can just go ahead and install
it. Zoom's installer is sneaky.
It's kind of the point of it, right?
Yeah, right. It's doing its job, I suppose.
But something to help me identify shadow IT would do wonders for me. But on top of that, just giving me that option to say, okay, we just found out that our users are using this. Let's just check a box and block it. Now, one takeaway, and Brian, maybe this is something you would enjoy because Brian's going more into the enterprise. I don't want to say he's leaving the SMB, but he likes the enterprise. What type of, and I don't know if this is a question for you, or maybe I'll ask the demo tomorrow. Can end clients log into your portal? So if they had an internal compliance department, they can run their reports and choose who gets blocked from what?
Well, if you're using the agent, I think you can assign policies to individual users, I think. And then you could have a custom policy which would block different things for different people. We pass on that information. So I think it's technically possible. I'm sorry, guys. This is so.
No, it's fine. I mean, I could ask it tomorrow, but it's more of an RBAC question just because. Yeah. Oh, here's another question for you. Are you channel only, or do you sell to anyone that comes to you?
I think pretty much anybody. You can get a $20 a month account for home use if you want.
I'm pro that. Like, I'm not a fan of channel only. So now consider this. When you have an enterprise that comes directly to you guys, they have a chances are they have a compliance department and they're going to want to run reports and they're going to want to restrict certain people. Maybe they have an Azure Active Directory group that's allowed to go to Facebook, but no one else is. That would be something interesting for you guys. And I can raise that with tomorrow's call. But
I think it would be good to raise it. I know we have Active Directory sync, so you can synchronize your ID groups with and then configure policies based on that in DNS filters. So that was a big project that was done last year, I think. Oh, dear.
It's all the same time. The last 2 years have just been one big ball of nothing.
I was thinking that what we need now is an alien invasion and the robots to rise up against us. And I think we have all the apocalypses covered.
I think, with all the drones being flown around these days, the robots are coming.
Yeah, just flip the switch, then it's just one off bingo, right?
So. Let Amazon have their way. We'll get autonomous. I guess my last question for you, unless Brian has anything else, just because I think this is what you guys were created for. When a C2 server is identified, what happens? So my computer sends out a request to a C2 server that you guys have obviously identified or seen before. What's the process there?
We'll send a DNS request to find out the IP address of the C2 server, and we will return the IP address of our block server rather than the real one.
Okay.
So your machine won't, your network won't be able to communicate with that. It won't know what the real IP address is.
And it would be seamless to us, barring a block page saying, hey, DNS filter has saved you from catastrophe.
Yeah. I mean, you probably won't even see it happen, to be honest. It will happen in the background. There'll be a piece of malware on your machine that would try and find out what it needs to do and fail.
I do have another question, Shiva. I don't know if you're down.
Go for it.
So back to the kind of the intelligence discussion, right? And I'm just thinking kind of security compliance. Obviously, you're going to have certain IPs that you're blocking that are a lot more dangerous than others, right? Wouldn't that be good intelligence for me to know? If a client, one of my client's users was trying to get to a new C2 server that just got stood up and that is causing a bunch of ransomware attacks, right? Because otherwise, if that gets blocked and then nothing else happens or nothing else alerts me, we're not made aware that we came close to the edge, right? And so that's an opportunity to maybe train the end user at the very least. Right.
Yeah.
If not, look into it further to make sure there's nothing else that might be of concern. You know what I mean? So what about some sort of alerting or feed into a SIM of certain log events, right, that are happening that are above a certain critical level that we might want to have more eyes on? Any thoughts around that?
So I think there's three things there that I can identify as kind of feature requests. So alerting, SIEM integration, and like a risk score. So separately, they're all useful. I think the risk score is probably the least interesting thing, to be honest. It, for some people, it is super interesting, but and for a researcher, it's definitely interesting. But for the end user, it's generally not that important. They just care that their threats are blocked. I definitely see the value in alerting on specific types of threats. Like for super bad ones, the timeliness usually can't be reacted to for it to be useful. Like it would have, because the lifetime of a C2 server is in like, I think like 6 hours average. It's not long.
Okay.
Yeah, they go down. I mean, there's obviously longer ones that last a lot longer, but the average lifetime is very short.
I have a question, just to sidetrack you for a second here. There's another product I use, and I can talk to you about it offline after we end here. They have identified a lot of C2 servers on Linode infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys are seeing that as well.
Some. I mean, not...
And DigitalOcean, sorry.
Yeah, DigitalOcean is just... Well, the thing is that they're massive hosting companies, so they're natural targets for this kind of stuff. We've definitely seen a lot there, but we don't see any more than other hosting providers, really, you know, percentage-wise. But a lot of it comes down to their own moderation policies or their own monitoring policies, like how well they're policing their own networks. So Amazon, it's a little bit harder to get stuff on there because they're, I think, a bit better. But Linode, DigitalOcean is particularly there. But it's the same thing. It will go in waves, usually. It'll get to a critical level where they'll have too many people complaining about them or leaving their network, and then they'll hire a bunch of people to monitor it, sysadmin, to make it better. You know, you'll see the same thing go through.
I think, with a 6-hour life cycle, it's really hard to pinpoint any of these, no matter where they go anyway.
It's hard to pinpoint them, but it's hard to prevent them. Yeah. It's you need a monitoring team or a reaction team to kind of, I don't work for a hosting company, so I don't see exactly what they do.
See, I look at your intelligence and I go, I'm paying DNS filter for this, right? That's most of, you know, the value, I would say, other than the efficiency and how you deliver that. And then I'm wondering, like, hey, you see a brand new C2 server or some new IP, maybe it's an IP, you're going to see a bunch of traffic trying to get to that, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be awesome for me to know that, hey, that IP's bad and be able to implement that other places, you know, with my security layers?
Yeah. I'm the wrong person to be talking to about it. I'm sorry, mate.
I think you're paying for their application of their intelligence. I don't think you're actually paying for their intelligence.
I know. And
it's all semantics.
I'm not saying I wouldn't be willing to pay more to port it into other products.
Triple his price.
But see, I'm in this consolidation of vendors move, right? And I think Shiva kind of touched on it earlier where he's like, I don't want to have to put one more agent, right, on a device. And so when I'm looking long term at my vendors, I'm trying to understand, like, are they kind of in their own space, or is something else that I use eventually going to swallow them up?
Interesting.
What is their IP? Is Microsoft ultimately going to take over what they're doing for me? You know what I mean? Those are the questions going around in my head. Go ahead, Shiva.
What would be interesting is if you or any vendor that's not Microsoft built something that is as well documented as the Graph API and say, hey, if you guys want to play with us, here's our stack of encyclopedias for our API. Go to town, build whatever you want and put it on them.
Yeah.
Give them the access, the doorway or the gate.
We have API docs.
Okay.
Partner integration is a bit more complicated than that. That's the problem, is that when you start interacting with any other partner, they have requests which are not supported, and it requires development time to do what they need, which is, you know, and there's a 6-month evaluation and a 6-month lead up to feature implementation. And then that's a year on minimum. It can be done quicker than that, but it's tough. And then it might not even work out. You know, they'll find someone else who's cheaper or better or faster, or they'll get sold. I don't know. It's a challenging thing to do. It feels like it shouldn't be, but
That's why you start with Microsoft, because you know they're not going to get sold.
They're not going anywhere. But I mean, that's it for me on my end. I do want to be mindful of Peter's time.
Thanks. No, I just want to come back quickly about the alerting thing. This is something that we're working on, alerting of some form. And I was talking about a while ago, but it is actively being in my team in particular is working on that. So again, I can't give you a timeline. It's going to be a while, but we'll get it.
Well, once you get a cloud radial integration, I can move away from Augment. That's the one thing I'm Augment integrates with cloud radial, shows all my clients what cloud apps their end users are accessing, shows them the policy we built around what's allowed, what's not allowed, but doesn't do any policy enforcing. So then in order to enforce policy, guess what I'm going over to? You know, DNS filter or a firewall or something along those lines, right? Which is a clunky process. So, but I do like the idea of the transparency with the clients and them understanding like, hey, they own this. Like, this is your decision that this is happening. This is what's being blocked, what's not being blocked. If something is malicious that happens down the road and it wasn't an app that we were blocking on this, you can't get mad at me. Like, this is this is what we said, right? I mean, that's kind of where I'm at with our fully managed clients that we are keeping moving forward. We're kind of refining that base. It's full transparency. I'm making them take ownership in their IT. This isn't like a iTech's got this for us. It's no, you made the decision to agree with our recommendation. So you got this thanks to our consulting, right? But anyway, I do appreciate your time. It was a lot of great insight.
Cool. I will say that, the feature request thing, the DNS filter app, I know in some places it seems like that just disappears into the void, but it's actively looked at and does make a difference if you want anything in particular that you're looking for that isn't supported, send through a message and people can vote on it and, it gets discussed. So,
okay, great.
Sounds good. Thanks for coming on, Peter.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.